Welcome to Modcast, a civilization podcast focused on modding. Tony Keel, Peter Steenbeke,
Bauta Snidus,
guest co-host Soren Johnson. That's all we're here for is the squiggles.
It's all about the squiggles.
Yeah, so I was playing your mod Maniac last night on my netbook.
Okay.
And I got it working on a little tiny ass netbook, and then it finally crashed.
What resolution does that have?
I use a 1300 by 768, and then I maximize screen to make it work. It's like the netbooks. The Civ doesn't work on netbooks usually, but there's a good fix. That crashed, so then I started playing Spore again. And I was playing Spore Galactic Adventures.
Oh, yeah? Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that game's pretty, it's pretty fun. I enjoy Spore. Every now and again.
Yeah, I guess I could assume, Galactic Adventures would definitely have some interest.
It's made by great guys, so,
For modders.
Okay, so let's, introduce ourselves.
Yes, yes. Well, then fine. Welcome to Modcast episode, what? 38?
No, special episode.
Modcast super duper special episode with a cherry on top.
I don't know, Tony. I mean, the guest lineup is going downhill a bit. I mean, this guy doesn't make mods. I mean, hasn't played any mods. Why would anyone care what he has to say?
Oh, Wouter. Wouter, you need to go back to your Netherland cave.
You don't have caves. It's all flat.
The caves are under the dikes. But anyways.
Okay, so let's do a little roll call.
This is a super duper special episode. Yeah, that's what I was getting into, but we have all the talkers out today, so. Alright, today we are joined with Kenneth Impaler WRG Perland.
Greetings, mortals.
Wouter, Locutus, Snyder.
That's your cue, Ken. Hello.
Peter, Maniac, Steenbeke.
Good night, everyone.
Oh, yes, it's late for him. With me, Tony Garrett's on keel, as usual. And with one of our, I'd say, best guests ever in any podcast ever created, Soren Johnson, creator of the code for Civ 3 and production lead in Civ 4, working with Spore on Will Wright, and on and on and on and on and on and on and on. How are you doing today, buddy?
Doing great. Glad to be here.
Modcast exclusive, where we bring you the hottest interviews in gaming and modding. And I understand that you are actually one of our four listeners that we actually have on the show. He's actually one of them.
Yeah, apparently. But no, it's great to all get an update on what's going on with the Civ 4 mod community. I knew that, you know, it would have a long, long lifespan. And, you know, it's even though I've, you know, moved on from Civ 4 for quite a while, it's like it's neat to see, you know, things still growing, still things still active, and things still changing.
And Civ is the game that keeps giving. Civ 4 was just, I think, perfectly designed to be expandable, and I think perfectly designed, as you originally said, Civ 4 is not a game as much it is as a modding platform.
Yeah, that's right. I tried to think of it as just a turn-based strategy platform, essentially. Yeah, it seems like that's worked out pretty well.
I think about 8 months ago, it was back on the top 10 list, and that's like four years after it was released, and it came back on the top 10 seller list on PC. That is nuts.
Yeah, I saw that. That was pretty cool. That was neat to see.
That was nuts. I mean, who's keeping 2K afloat at this point? You know what I'm saying?
Well, there is this little Grand Theft Auto thing that It slightly contributes, but...
Alright, well, I'll tell you what. I haven't played Grand Theft Auto, but I have played a lot of Civ and Spore and all those other things.
Yeah, Spore does not keep 2K afloat, seeing as how it's made by EA.
Yeah, that helps.
Speaking of which, how is it over there with Will Wright and all those fun people?
It's going pretty well. I mean, I'm no longer sort of involved with Spore per se, but there's still a lot of interesting projects going on under that franchise. And most of which I think I can't talk about. But I moved on to, you know, working on browser-based strategy games. Currently, I'm still kind of a team of one, so things are, you know, just going slowly, just the way things were when we started up Civ 4. And but I'm really excited with what's going on. I'm excited the possibilities of what you can do in a browser now. You know, things just are changing really quickly, and you know, I think the tech now is probably somewhere where games were back in maybe the, you know, late 80s or something like that.
Okay, well, one of the things I wanted to start off with, I mean, for some of our listeners who aren't so familiar with this, tell us a little bit about how your career developed, I mean, from school to all the places you worked at before and after Firaxis. Just give us kind of a bit of a timeline.
Okay.
In that respect.
Well, I was at Stanford back in the late 90s, and I kind of always liked to joke that Civilization was sort of the perfect, like, the only game I could ever work for, because when I was in school, I double majored in history and computer science. I actually tried to combine the two. Like, I had my history honors thesis or whatever and my CS final project were actually the same thing. As soon as I was able to get, as soon as I graduated, you know, that was good timing, because it just happened to be when Brian Reynolds was leaving Firaxis to form Big Huge Games. You know, the upshot of that was that suddenly Civ 3 lost its development team. You know, it was really great timing for me. So then I sent my resume into Firaxis, you know, flew out, met Sid, met Jeff. You know, they hired me for that project. And I think at that point there was probably about a year and a half to go until we shipped Civ 3. So I started off, I think, just working on, you know, getting some of the basic new concepts working for Civ 3, worked on the AI, came up with some of the ideas for the new diplomacy system, the resources, the culture. So I was eventually able to get a co-design credit on Civ 3. Then I was definitely heavily involved in the, I guess we'll tactfully refer to as the patching process of that game. And which was actually, I think, probably my biggest, really what I would think of as the pivotal moment of my career, actually, was that patching process. Because that was the first time, you know, I sort of really was waded in deep into the community and saw, you know, what you can learn from the community. You know, there's certainly people that, you know, you're not necessarily going to be able to get good feedback from, but then there's tons and tons of people who can give you incredible feedback. And being able to filter through that noise is really, really important. And I think that we made, you know, really, really great progress on Civ 3 as the first, second, third, fourth, you know, patch came out. I was pretty decently happy with the single player of Civ 3 by the time we finished up the last patch for the first expansion. That was a long process, and it taught me a lot about what's possible if you engage the community, about, you know, how they like your product. So when it came time to start working on Civ 4, which, you know, I was, you know, basically the first man on that project, you know, one of the first things I said was really important was, that we could, that we'd always be able to, first of all, that we'd always be able to have a playable prototype, you know, that's a game that, you know, we'd be playing amongst ourselves all the time.
That's the Firaxis way.
Yeah, exactly. And we also really wanted to finally make a multiplayer version of Civ, which worked. And the only way to do that would be to, you know, as they say in the software industry, eat our own dog food, you know, where every Wednesday night, you know, we'd play a, you know, 2-hour game of Civ 4 and, you know, see what we liked, see what we didn't like. That went on for basically the first year of the project, but then the other thing I thought was really important is that I wanted to get the community involved in Civ 4 as early as possible. So about a year and a half, before we shipped the game, we brought on, some of the, you know, sort of the leading lights of the Civ fan community into a private beta to test the game out. You know, we got people from the single-player community, from the multiplayer community, from the modding community, so they each felt like they had an equal say in, you know, what we were developing with the game.
From the Call to Power community?
Oh, the Call to Power community, yes, yes, and yeah, and it was, I mean, when I started Civ 4, I actually really did not know, you know, for years and years, I had seen people talk about how great the modding was for Call to Power and how important modding was, and it was just something I had very little experience with during Civ 3, so... actually, a lot of the modding that did work out for Civ 3 was could be credited to some of the other people on the team, especially Mike Breakright, took a lot of effort into making a good editor for Civ 3. So when I started Civ 4, I really went back and I looked at the mods for Civ 2. I looked at I think that's when I contacted Wouter, I think, to ask him about what's the deal with Call to Power? Why was everyone so excited about what it could do? And just trying to see, what was I missing? You know, what could be done with a great moddable strategy game? I tried to engage everyone. You know, I wanted Civ 4 to be a big tent, you know, that everyone was invited to, you know. Yeah, and I guess, you know, worked on that project for 2.5 years, it came out, did very well. We've seen some really interesting mods, and it's also been a really popular game, so... Yeah, it's been...
Yeah, I personally didn't have anything to do with Civ 4 until it came out.
Yeah, so it came out. I think a lot of people felt like they were...
You know, that's actually when I stopped being a lurker when you were doing that Civ 4 community.
Yeah, well, there's certainly, I think, some people who were in sort of wait-and-watch mode of Civ 4. You know, they were going to believe it when they saw it, which is fine.
Well, I think this brings up an interesting point that I wanted to ask you about. The way that modding has changed from Civ 3... to Civ 4, I think in Civ 3 you had more basically people making scenarios. It's kind of a set piece battle, specific time, specific place, all the cities laid out, etc., etc. And in Civ 4, it seems we've got a lot more dominance of like the total remakes. Is this just because the tools are available? I mean, is the total remake what people really want to make, and the scenario is kind of that's more the fallback if we don't have the really powerful tools that allow us to make a total remake?
Yeah, you know, it's a tricky question because I definitely feel like the tools we provide kind of definitely dictates what the output is. You know, like Civ 2, for example, had a really great event system, right? But the actual ability to mod some of the values in the game was just some extent limited, I believe. Wasn't there kind of a hard cap on how many units you could have, or I forget all these details, but there was still some stuff about, you know, some of the buildings and units that were still somewhat hard-coded into the game, but it had a really powerful trigger and event system, right?
Well, you know, some guys did reverse engineer some of that stuff.
Eventually.
Okay, well, that's cool, but it seems like a lot of the best Civ, you know, Civ 2 mods were kind of these, like, I remember this one great Fellowship of the Ring one, this interesting one that was like the Odyssey, one that was the interesting Jules Verne mod, where it was all about these really complicated, trees of all these different things that could happen. If you step here, this pops up here, and, you know, all this stuff that, didn't feel like a normal Civ game, but created, you know, kind of almost more of a storybook feel. And then when you moved on to Civ 3, we really opened up the data to modding, where, you know, we really stuck to this belief that, you know, there's no such thing as a temple, there's no such thing as a spearmint. You know, we were neutral on the data. The data that came in that determined what the units and the buildings and technologies were could be anything at all, which meant the AI didn't make any assumptions about what to build, and the game rules didn't make any assumptions about what, you know, buildings and units were there. And so that led to what I always found the most interesting, well, I guess two of the most interesting Civ 3 mods to me, which was Rise mod, which all his names are very similar, so I forget which one it was exactly called, and the Double Your Pleasure mod, which were all sort of very data-intensive mods. So that's actually what...
Double Your Pleasure was technically a kitchen sink mod.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I think of Civ 3 modding, that's actually what I tend to think of is like the ones that were focused on, you know, altering the rules through data. But, I honestly, as a, from a player, have never really been much of a scenario guy. So I definitely just will take your word for it that there were a ton of great Civ 3 scenarios. And I think that's definitely a result of, sort of that comprehensive map editor that, was provided with Civ 3. Something which, I definitely think you could say.
To be fair, I think that was mostly Civ 2, Civ 3.
What's that?
Civ 3 had less of, I think Civ 3 had less of that. It was especially Civ 2 had a lot of scenarios. So like you said, because of the event system,
So for me, I usually think of Civ 2 as having, all these great scenarios. And then Civ 3 had some interesting, very data intensive mods where, it was all about changing the game by altering the numbers behind the units and buildings and stuff. And also the ability to have, essentially as many texts as you wanted to. And then with Civ 4, it was very much, we were just trying to expose everything we possibly could. So, not just the data, but, the interface and the AI and, everything we possibly could allow you to mod, we did, with the exception of some kind of hard-coded graphical stuff. So I guess that's the interesting question. Like, are these sort of like open-ended random map mods what people want, or is it just because that kind of flows more naturally with what Civ 4 always is? I think making scenarios is cool and interesting. Is kind of cool and interesting. But if we didn't see many more of that Civ 4, it's probably because we didn't necessarily provide a very user-friendly map and scenario editor like was available in Civ 2. Data editor as was available in Civ 3. So I think with Civ 4 you saw a lot more kind of team-based mods, people who are interested in modding kind of were looking around for projects to join. This has always been true, but I just felt like it was especially true with Civ 4, where, they could kind of pool their resources and some people would organize the mods and other people would focus on art and other people would focus on, text or whatever. And so I think that's part of why we've seen more total conversions.
That's been a big factor. You're getting team sizes of 5 and 6 people, someone usually being a designer / programmer. It actually starts to look like the professional teams where you have a division of labor into design, programming, and art.
Especially Fall from Heaven. Fall from Heaven, great example.
Yeah. They're definitely a classic example. And it's been interesting. That kind of mirrors the developments in the professional game industry itself. These teams are really diversifying and growing.
My experience is kind of different. I kind of see that most of the big mods are still made by one big guy. Fall from Heaven, Kyle, Rise and Fall, Rai, and
Well, there's one lead man.
There's one guy with a vision. There's a whole team too.
And there's this one crazy guy who does Planetfall. That guy's insane.
Yeah, but perhaps I'm an exception, but usually the guys who contribute, except for me, they constantly rotate. Someone stays 6 months, but then leaves, and then someone other joins, and so it's constantly shifting. So, my impression is in some ways it's a team project, but in other ways it's still, solo project.
You're never quite alone with your internet because there's so many resources and people who just want to do a little something to help or give you feedback, though.
I think it's those mods that make it. If there's one guy behind it that's really, really passionate and keeps pushing, keeps keeping the project alive, that's why there's usually the best mods are the ones with one guy behind it, because he's constantly been pushing it and keeping it alive.
Yes, that's always important. You see people coming up with like, hey, let's have this as a mod, and it's like, they're constantly asking for something on the internet. It's like, oh, could someone make this? This would be a cool idea. And it's like, nothing happens unless someone gets behind it and decides to do it.
Yeah, people do it themselves. You want a mod.
The people who don't know a lick of programming and learn to program just so they can the mod they want.
What to me is interesting is, I think that's mirrored between the professional game industry and the mod community as well. Like, I think most great games, you can usually say that, there's some one guy behind it who, is ultimately responsible for, the quality of the project and pushing things forward. And, I think you see that in a lot of creative, projects, definitely. Even people, projects which are, more solo affairs, I think just the way, the mod community has developed in, you know, places like Civ Fanatics, you know, it's, there's very few people who aren't pulling bits and pieces from other projects. Like, one of the things I always found very interesting was going on to the forums and seeing the, I forgot even the name of it, but basically like the mod component sub-forum, you know, which was just like chunks that people could grab for their mods, you know, and like, that's yeah. fantastic, right? Because that really is allowing people to, you know, develop stuff rapidly and, you know, work modularly and, you know, I can build off of you and you can build off of me, you know, like that's really cool.
Yeah, I did a lot of stuff that was kind of involved in that angle mm-hmm. of trying to make it even easier to
right.
put chunks
yep.
together. You know, the whole thing we did with the XML to basically load more XML files, and I was involved in this project where we were trying to basically put a bunch of the code chunks together mm-hmm. that everyone had written into one DLL
right.
so that you could use it without having to actually recompile the whole thing. You know, there was limited success on some of these things just because it's so
yeah.
wide and diverse and everything.
Yeah, those were interesting projects.
Going in a million
so,
different directions.
Those.
So, yeah, it's always going to be tricky.
So going back to, you said there's no really easy-to-use scenario editor or map editor or anything like that for Civ 4. Was that a very deliberate decision?
Yeah, it was a deliberate decision. We only had so many resources. And, you know, every time it came down to the decision of exposing, you know, like at some point, like, we didn't originally, exposing the code, for example, was not originally on the plan. It was just something I just kept pushing for, right? And
thank you for that.
yeah.
Well, right. I mean,
you made a lot of people a lot of money for that, by the way.
yeah. And, I mean, I would love to be on one of these projects where you don't have to make these choices, but, you know, if you had to choose between a scenario editor and exposing the code to a DLL, you know, which would you choose, right? And I'm sure there might be some people who prefer a scenario editor, but, I mean, I made my choice, and, you know, that's what we ended up with, you know.
Well, there's a few good editors that the community came out with already, so, like, MapView, great
mm-hmm.
guy.
Yeah, and
great guy.
I don't want to say, like, this is what I was planning for, but, I was definitely hoping that some of that stuff would develop. You know, I don't think there's really been, like, yeah, certainly a perfect one that would rival, you know, what you might see in Civ 2. But, you know, that was definitely part of the concept that, you know, the XML files are, you know, a standard format, and also that just the fact that the map scenario files are just plain text, you know, just a very simple file format.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew that people would build, you know, sort of off-the-shelf, you know, editors
yeah.
to work with these. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say it came out a bit, and I wanted to say this, but, you know, you should have gone a little bit further with the editor, because I'd say that's one of the only weak point in the modding of Civ 4 is the world map editor,
mm-hmm.
to be quite honest. But that's it. That's the weakness.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think we recognize that, you know, and I guess there was two things. One was resources, and the other was kind of a leftover from the Civ 3 experience where we felt like putting Chrome onto the editing became a really big bottleneck in the process, if that makes sense to you guys. You know, having the really nice Civ 3 rules editor, for example, and I think we made totally the right decision by just sticking with XML and just leaving it at that, not trying to wrap that stuff in some sort of editor. But the problem was, anytime anyone added a new, you know, piece of data or a new chunk to the game or new value that could be altered, Mike would have to go into the editor and, you know, find a new place. I remember at one point he was just running out of space on the page for buttons and pull down menus and list boxes and, you know, all that stuff.
Oh yeah, I remember that thing.
yeah, I mean it just got, you know, ridiculous. And I think there was definitely a fear that type of thing would happen if we really committed full on to a map and scenario editor for Civ 4. So that was part of why that decision got made. I mean, my hope would be, you know, if you know, going forward, you know, people are trying to learn from Civ 4, they would see that's an opportunity, you know, to make the project even better, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know.
Totally. Okay, someone asked another question.
Well, do we want to move on from Civ 4 into some of the newer stuff? Let's go, like, to Spore now, or?
I would like to talk about Spore, then, if that's the case, because we've gone to Civ 4, and Civ 4 is reaching its age limit, I think, in a year or two, but a game that's more recent and in some ways more ambitious, if you've played it, is Spore. Now, Spore, I don't think, has the technical depth.
Yeah, it only tries to simulate the entire history of the universe. It's a little bit more ambitious.
Yeah, it goes, instead of starting at 4000 BC, like we're all used to with a guy with a big wooden stick, we actually start a little bit earlier to like 1 billion years after the creation of the Earth. And you start as a little cartoon single-cell organism, which, by the way, the scientists were kind of irritated with the cartoonish aspect of evolution, but I love it. Then you eat little, you can choose to eat plants or meat, and then you go on to become a creature who leaves the ocean and evolves new body parts to better interact or fight creatures. And then after you've become the biggest brain creature on the planet, you become a tribe. And then it's a real-time strategy with a little bunch of little members of your tribe. Then the civilization stage, which I understand the Soren had a fingers in very heavily, where you try to dominate the rest of the globe of your countrymen, of the rest of the world. And then after all of that is the biggest stage of all, which is the galaxy. And you literally have an entire galaxy with, I think it would take you 600 years to visit every star or something. 600 real life years to visit every star.
Yep.
But yeah, that's kind of nuts. But Soren, what do you got to say about how did you like that?
Well, Spore is an interesting game to work on. I mean, to me, the thing that really pulled me in from coming from the outside of the project was just the concept of procedural content and pollination, and you know the fact that they, you know, the Sims community was also looking at. You know, they have also a really big modding community. And I think when they were building Spore, they were looking at them as well as thinking, like, how can we make their jobs easier for them? You know, how can we, internalize what they're trying to accomplish, which is, you know, they want to make all this cool content and share it with people. But, you know, it's the same issue that a lot of Civ modders face, which is they do all this great work, but how many people are actually out there looking for Civ mods, right? So with Spore, the idea is like, hey, let's give people these great editing tools in the game and just make sharing stuff automatic. You know, that's something that happens no matter what. You know, it's just part of the play experience. And like, to me, that was what was really cool about the Spore project.
Kind of like modding is the game now.
And yeah, I got to be involved, heavily with the civilization level of that game. Got to, work on sort of polishing up the design for that, you know, over the last, I guess, year and a half. Writing the AI for that and just doing some work trying to get that level where it needs to be to ship. Spore is a really big game and it was a production challenge, that's for sure.
Now, is the design of something like Spore, I mean, like, I imagine Will Wright is, you know, at the top of the whole pyramid here, but is it pretty much sliced up into each section of the game has its own? Sub-designer,
yeah, each section
you were in charge of
each section of the game definitely had like its own team, essentially. There were some designers who were over multiple areas. The space one was the one that was kind of the biggest and had kind of the most designers with their fingers in the pie. But the teams were kind of split up, and you know, Will was kind of there as somebody, play the game regularly, give us advice, and talk to each one of the individual teams about.
So he's basically the Don.
The thought of what they were doing, how what they're doing was fitting. One of the big challenges with Spore is this concept of continuity. You know, how you get one level to fit into the next level to fit into the next level. You know, it's putting all these games into one game was a big challenge, and would people understand that on one level they were controlling a single character, and then suddenly they were, they didn't have an avatar, and they were controlling the whole civilization, how would people handle that? And then when you go to space, you go back to controlling an avatar, this is that's a pretty big interface and conceptual challenge.
And I think it was executed well. I think the replay value is high, but for me, I play in spurts with Spore. Like, I will play, make some creatures, and then I'll break, and then go back. Also, we did cover the first Spore mods in a show last season. I don't know if you remember, Soren, do you?
No, I don't remember that one, actually.
Yeah, go in the archive. It's some guy made a mod, modded the space game, he modded, he made a hack, remember?
Yeah, okay, I think I remember that.
Okay,
yeah.
He made the asymmetry hack, which I made some. I made a beholder from D&D with that hack. It was pretty cool.
Spore was kind of funny because, in a sense, it was like the most moddable and least moddable game ever because, like.
Ken, you said that before.
Because the modding was so.
Yeah, modding is the game.
Yeah, it's so integral to the game that, like, modding it outside of the game was not easy at all. And it wasn't meant to be. I mean, that it was meant to be, like, a walled garden, essentially, of modding. And I think that's a challenge. Anytime you. Because at Firaxis, we exposed a lot for Civ 4, but we really, after that, we kind of took a hands-off approach. We're like, this is how we're developing the game, and if you discover these files, then, you know, fine, you know, but we take no responsibility for it whatsoever. There's a big advantage to doing that.
I see.
Yeah, it's almost like in Spore, when they're providing you certain paths of modability, which is making the creatures and making all the other stuff that's part of the game, you've got a well-trotted path there, but everything else off of that, almost by definition, has to be restricted in order to make that path work.
Right. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. Although, I was really excited to see what they did with the expansion to Spore, though. Like, I feel like that's really a great direction.
That's Galactic Adventures, right?
Ahead. Right, yeah, because that allows people to, you know, build their own worlds and have, you know, these rules inside them and victory conditions and, create experiences for other players. You know, I think for a lot of people, Spore.
I think City
of Heroes, City of Villains. Yeah, they created.
They have the story editor, don't they?
Yeah, they have an editor in there that lets you create missions, which, you know, leads to some interesting problems when you can actually create experience points. You can get actually experience points and items from those missions. You know, unfortunately, we didn't have to deal with that problem. I mean, there's a lot of companies that are interested. I mean, obviously, Little Big Planet's another one that, you know, is in this space. There's a lot of companies that are interested in, you know, experimenting with these type of ideas. You know, modding going mainstream,
Do you think that's like the future of modding? That modding is going to become the game? Or is this sort of Civ 4 approach of here's the code, do what you want with it? Is that sort of gone its way out, do you think?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. You know, I can't give you the answer for that. I think that the best case is someone who can really wrap things up well so that they can do both.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that you can expose what's available in Civ 4, but then find a safe way to present that information to players, that modding stuff to players. I know that I'm curious to see what Stardock comes up with their next game, their fantasy game, which has two titles, so I can never remember either of them. So Brad will be upset with me, I don't remember the name, but I told him...
They've been working on that for a couple of years, though.
Yeah, they're working on it for a while. I told him he should change the title, too. What is the name of that game? I was like, what is the name of that game? Elemental Magic? Elemental something?
Elemental War of Magic.
Yeah, something like that.
Elemental, we'll just call that. But anyway, they're going to allow you to mod stuff in the game, and then they're going to be saving that for you server-side so that your stuff will be pollinated to other players. So I guess that I could imagine that's maybe like a Civ 4 mod that was XML only that they would, like, broadcast to other people, or maybe they're allowing them to broadcast a bits of a scripting language, too. I'm not sure. I'm curious to see how that works. Blizzard is probably doing some stuff with this, although I don't know for sure. Because clearly they've had some really advanced editors, right? And when you see mods like Defense of the Ancients, which are huge in certain parts of the world for Warcraft 3, bigger really than Warcraft 3 itself ever was.
It's a new genre.
That's built on the stuff they did. So I have to imagine that with StarCraft 2, they're thinking of, you know, maybe providing a way to package that up, because still with Defense of the Ancients, you have to download their stuff and install it whenever. It's not at all visible to someone who doesn't know how to use Google. I imagine they're, you know, going to try to solve that problem, but I don't know for sure.
Or you'd need to know the community that those kinds of files are hosted in to get into modding.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know,
you think to even look for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You definitely have to Google. Luckily, Civ Fanatics has a really good Alexa rank.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is this weird problem, you know, there's all this stuff available, but how do you make people even know that they can go look for something like that? I mean, most people are just missing that first step.
Advertisement. One commercial. One commercial that mentions that you would get a surge of freaks and retards. I'm sorry.
I think you see some games that actually puts our stuff on like the main menu of the game. That's maybe the best way to go. I mean, every player sees that.
I mean, I'm actually trying to solve this problem with the project I'm working on, but just giving up on retail whatsoever and just doing it through the web. You know, the parts of the game that you want to modify, you know, you edit it on the web, it stays on the web, it stays on a server, and that's the end of the story, right? And that's going to limit what you can mod right off the bat until our technology base grows, if that makes sense.
Okay. Well, here's another question that I think I've heard you mention this on a couple of other either podcasts or on your blog, that you think strategy gaming is kind of in trouble. It's the, what do they call it? Fighter Sim Death Spiral? I believe Sid actually came up with that term from actually working on Fighter Sims. They basically get so complicated and then they squeeze out the fringe audience and then it gets more hardcore.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the way we always joke is the manuals get bigger and bigger and the sales get smaller and smaller, you know? I'm afraid that's happened with strategy games where, especially with RTS games, where there's just this kind of like huge, very high baseline of conventions that everyone's supposed to know when you go into game. You know, about what left click means, what right click means, what, population count means, what your base means, what even the whole point of the game is. Age of Empires to someone who doesn't know what RTS is supposed to be, and they'll just be spending the time building farms and being like, oh, this is kind of neat, you know, look, they're logging their farms, and then, you know, 10 minutes in, you know, they'll get completely rampage and they'll have no idea what's going on.
Noob.
it's a pretty big leap to make for a lot of people. Yeah, so I mean, that's something I'm worried about. Like, I think, and it's also, I think, kind of disappointing because we're only really making one type of real-time strategy game. You know, real-time strategy used to mean a much more varied thing than it means nowadays. You know, I think if there was, but I think a big part of the...
Now it pretty much means resource collection, which converts into units which you crush your opponents with.
Well, when the advent of the 3D age, a lot of game types got kind of obsoleted.
Yeah, and I think that it's kind of... I think a big part of the problem is that there's only one avenue there. For a long time, there's only been one avenue for these type of games to come through, which is, you know, a $50 box at Best Buy. But now that's changing. Yeah. But, you know, I haven't necessarily seen a ton of new types of strategy games come through the new distribution pipes. I think it's kind of, so far, I think it's benefited other genres a lot more than it has strategy games. But I'm certainly hopeful for the future. I think with, you know, things like Steam and the web and, live arcade, you know, there should be a lot more.
Something like Tower Defense and Plants vs. Zombies, that's something we didn't have before.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the best RTS I've played the last few years has been Desktop Tower Defense.
Zombies, the great undiscovered genre.
Yep. So yeah, I'm hopeful for the future, but yeah, I do wish that, you know, we could make strategy games with AAA production values that weren't the same variation of, StarCraft, Age of Empires, Command & Conquer, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what you got, you know. Now, I have a question for you, and this is probably on a lot of people's minds, curious to know what you're working on now. Now, Soren, can I ask you an aside question off the record really quick?
Sure.
You know, you're doing some kind of beta test.
Right.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah. I'm doing a beta.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm doing a beta test. I'm making a website that's, you know, built for strategy games, so that you can play. And right now the games are fairly simple, but it's just a way to be able to play games with your friends online, through your browser. You know, right now there's a card game, there's like a tactics Advance Wars type game, there's like a sort of a risk-style territorial control game, the multiplayer.
These are all, by the way, very, very, very basic games.
Right.
Which is kind of, a lot of people were wondering about that.
Yes.
They played the game and they're like, well, this game's just so basic. Is this a test? Are we testing certain types of code? Or are these going to be produced games?
What do you want to offer that hasn't been done in other games already?
I'd say right now they're mostly sort of technological test beds. There will be, you know, more advanced and developed games coming down the pipe. But on the other hand, I also view the games that I've developed so far as kind of atoms for greater things. Like, for example, the little tactics game, right? I mean, like, you know, perhaps as it is right now, it's, you know, it's just a simple game that's just kind of fun. But, you know, once you make it moddable, well, now people can make their own units, they can make their own maps, they can make, you know, scenarios, they can make campaigns. You know, maybe people can start, you know, if we get the technology ability available, people will start scripting AIs for it. You know, you can build custom leagues. You can, you know, there's a bunch of things you can do. But that, you know, that sort of basic, you know, atom of like, you know, card games can work online, you know, little grid-based games can work online. You know, that's kind of like was my first step down this road.
And by the way, Soren, if it's all right, listeners, we'll have a link for you to come join the beta. You just have to go to weplayciv.com. Is that what it is, Water?
Yeah, sure. Weplayciv.com and post in the thread in the, what is it, the community forums if you want to sign up.
Yeah, and then you'll get access.
We'll add you.
Yeah. So we'll provide that link for you guys, Soren, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. I mean, the beta is open to everyone. I mean, mm-hmm. We just have
yeah, that's public.
We just have a small step for getting into the sort of the private forum where we talk about it, but there's really no limitation on membership. You know, anyone can play. You know, we want people to play. I'm not really looking to overwhelm our server right now because it is really just a test, you know, just to see how this goes. But, you know, I want people to play. So, you know, it's not really something we're advertising, but, you know, certainly for the, you know, the community of people, you know, who listen to the, this podcast, you know, I mean, I think that would be exactly the type of people we'd like to try the game out. And I'm hoping to expose some of the modding stuff soon. So, you know, now probably a good time for people who are interested in modding to try to check it out. I mean, it's going to be a bumpy ride. Like it will work, but there will be definitely issues. So, you know, that's, sort of inherent in working on a beta test. But, you know, I hope the people who try it out, you know, see not just what's there right now, but see what the potential is. I mean, that's to me what's exciting about making strategy games on the web is you can do interesting 2D stuff right now. And, you know, there's nothing preventing us from making more complex games. It's just a matter of time and, you know, attention and effort.
Hey, and Soren, don't forget the mobile age. All those games for mobiles now. Big bucks in those little apps you get for your fancy phones.
Yep, it's true.
Yeah, I wonder.
And these games right here look perfect to be ported over right now to a mobile OS, you know?
Yep, no, that's true. I mean, there's more potential clients than, you know, we can think of, you know, and Facebook and MySpace. I mean, there's so many different places you can stick a game nowadays, so.
And there's money there right now. There's whole companies starting up.
Yep, absolutely.
So, yeah, the long-term goal, are you really working towards sort of like a real full game, like an Icarium or, I don't know, World of Warcraft, but then all online and in the browser? Or is it really meant as a platform or both?
I'd say both. There's a number of ideas I have for games I'd like to try on the web, and some of them are bigger and some of them are smaller, and we've started with the smaller ones. But a big part of the project is also, you know, making games that are going to enable other people to make interesting games that, you know, they can share with their friends. You know, I mean, if someone, you know, makes this really interesting mod for the tactics game, you know, they're going to be, you know, the people going out there on forums like, hey, check out this game I made, check out these rules I did, so on and so forth. I mean, people already do that, you know, when, you know, there's a lot of people who will, you know, sort of, you know, pimp Fall from Heaven, obviously, but not everyone has Civ 4, not everyone's willing to install a mod, so on and so forth. But when something's on the web, all they have to do is click on a link and they can try it right away, you know?
Yeah. That'd be sick. Well, so what do you really got your fingers into right now, Soren, is what I want to know.
What's that?
What do you really, really got your fingers into right now? Any spoilers?
What's coming next? Well, I'm afraid I'm not going to be tight-lipped about anything else coming down the pipe. You know, if you're interested in this project, you know, just, you know, try it out, join the forum, and, you know, every month or so there'll be something, you know, something new, interesting that comes down.
Yeah, well, I tried, guys. Listeners, yeah. I tried to poke him for what he's doing next, but he's tight-lipped.
Let me get this track. When I was at 4Axis, I heard some rumors, though I never actually got to see anything, but they said that you had made a really, really awesome prototype for a game never got made. Is it cool to, you know, talk about this, or is this something you might, you know, think of trying to re-implement in your new
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, there was a game I worked on between Civ 3 and Civ 4, and a lot of people really did love it. It was a very, very fun game to play. It was multiplayer. It was real time. It was maybe half an hour to an hour sessions. It wasn't something we were able to move into production, which was too bad. But I do think the ideas behind it are solid game design ideas. I mean, it's nothing that you haven't necessarily seen other places, but maybe not in this specific combination, if that makes sense. It is new. It would be seen as innovative, and it was fun. So I think.
?
I mean, there's no doubt that, I do feel like that's some unfinished business there, because I felt like I made a really fun game, really fun design, and it wasn't, it's still locked away, from people.
Well, it sounds like you need to start a game company.
Now, does this get into the whole idea of the 2K viewing Firaxis as the Civilization studio, and that was, you think, one of the reasons why this didn't go anywhere? Because it didn't fit with the model of what...
Yeah, well, I think it's probably...
The studio was supposed to
be. It'd be difficult for me to comment on what's going on inside of Firaxis, especially now. Back then, well...
Well, I mean, back then.
Ultimately, I put a lot of time into Civilization, and I just wasn't sure how much more I could give to the series, I definitely did need to do something different, and...
Everyone needs a breath of fresh air, even modders.
Yep. And...
And yet, even now, you can't seem to write a column without talking about Civ 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm all burnt out on Civilization, too. I mean, I'm messing around with my own stuff now. It's totally different.
I have to look for opportunities to do stuff that I haven't done before. And, of course, that was part of the reason I came to EA. So,
just a last question is, what about your personal life? Where do you live? Do you have a family? How's that going for you?
I live in Oakland, California. Nearby the offices are in Emeryville, which is where the Bay Bridge meets the East Bay. And I live with my lovely wife and my 1-year-old son.
Oh, congratulations!
Here in the Oakland Hills. Thank you very much. He's going to turn one on October 26th.
Oh, isn't it great? You have a little boy.
What's that?
You have a little boy.
Mm-hmm, yeah, a little son.
Yeah, I got a boy and I got a 3-month-old little girl right now.
Oh, wow, that's cool. I really love it. I loved it much more than I thought I would. I mean, I was looking forward to it, but I mean, I just, you don't know what it feels like to be a parent until you actually are one,
Definitely. I agree with you. And the non-parents don't know what we know,
Yep.
Yeah, it's like a secret little club.
I was going to try to figure out the end of this segment to be like a gay joke involving Ken and Wouter, but I wasn't really sure what I should go with, so I was going to ask Peter.
Me?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't really catch what you were saying, the conversation is spotty, so...
Well, I was going to make a joke that says that Ken and Wouter are gay.
Okay, hold on, hey, I got it. How much do you make in royalties for those shirts with your name on them?
Which?
They were really popular in the 90s. They had, like, this little nerdy-looking guy with a bunch of scantily-clad women on them.
Are you talking about the Johnson shirts?
Yes. God. How much money did you ever see from that?
They totally ripped me off. I got nothing.
Today, in North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44121-288-7659. That's 44121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at ThePolycast or email us at ThePolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Modcast,
Revcast,
or Polycast, or about Polycast in general, log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Today we've been joined with Soren Johnson. and he's told us all about all kinds of stuff. Also, today we've been joined with Kenneth, Impaler WRG Furland.
Farewell, mortals.
Wilder, the cutest, Snyders.
Good night.
Peter, Maniac, Steinbeke.
Sweet dreams.
I'll never say your name right, I try every time. And me, Tony Garrett-Zakiel, as always, we hope to hear from you guys soon. And listeners, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Goodbye.
Hey, you skipped over Soren.
Don't forget me.
Say goodbye to all the listeners.
Right. Goodbye, everybody. It was fun to be here.
Thank you for coming. I hope we didn't bore you too much. And we are pretty crazy over here, so.
Yep, no, it's cool.
Yeah, crazy right. Like a fox.
We'll do it, happy to do it again.
Record date, October 14th, 2009. Civilization 4, Warlords Beyond the Sword sound clips, copyright, Take 2 Interactive. Copyright 2009, Civilized Communications at civcom.net.
Come on, guys, get a phone call.
Whatever, Ken. Is it the president?